This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
We've killed diamonds. We've killed long lunches. We've killed mayonnaise. Soon, we'll kill the Conservative Party. Or will we? My name is Marie LeConte, and I'm a millennial. My generation has been accused of destroying all the things that make life worth living. We're now being accused of not voting Tory, despite reaching the age where we should be doing so. If we do not head rightwards anytime soon, the party may disappear altogether. What's happening to us? Are we really a unique generation? What are we doing to electoral politics? Here with me today in the bunker to discuss this is Professor Bobby Duffy, Director of the Policy Institute at King's College London. Hello, Bobby.
Hey, Marie.
You wrote a book on generational divides, which is quite literally called The Generation Divide. What made you look into this topic in the first place?
I think it was recognising that so much of our generational discussion is about conflict and even war between generations. When you look at the framing of how generations are discussed, it's almost always in those terms, one against the other, particularly everyone hating boomers or everyone hating millennials is the kind of main protagonists in this. It was trying to explore what those divides really are, because so much of it is fake. But underlying that, there are some really important generational differences and divides in the end.
So in the introduction to the book, you say that the one sentence summary is, I quote, generational thinking is a truly big idea that has been horribly corrupted by terrible stereotypes and cliches. So could you explain what you mean in the first half of that sentence? Why do generations actually matter?
Yeah, they're hugely important in how societies change and reshape themselves. It is some of the biggest thinkers in philosophy and sociology put generational difference right at the heart of societal development. So French philosopher Auguste Comte effectively said that generations are probably the key determinant of the speed of generational change. And it's partly because we get stuck in our ways once we get past a certain age. So society needs renovation from one generation to the next, as he said. So we've got these really big ideas about life and death and societal change. But then what we've done with generational thinking is turn it into millennials are killing the napkin industry or whatever else it is that they're killing, which is a real shame. So they do matter because our formative years are really important in shaping our worldview. Generations are constantly developing, and they are a key driver of societal change overall.
For the record, I'd like to say that I say neither here nor there on napkins, but so on actually what you were talking about. So you quote in the book sociologist Karl Mannheim on the fact that generations are a social identity formed by common experiences, and that rapid technological and social advances can reinforce that. So I'm a bit biased because I wrote a book on how different generations treat the internet. But so do you think online culture and the internet in general can be blamed for at least a portion of this narrative of kind of generational warfare?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. I mean, there's a couple of really important points here, is it? That firstly, denigrating young people is an absolute constant of human history. We always think the current generation of young are uniquely weird or wrong. But what that kind of social media and technology allowed us to do is to denigrate them at scale. And it puts it into an information environment where division and conflict are rewarded, because those types of comments and discussions travel further and faster. So it is definitely the case that millennials bore the brunt of a lot of this, because they were coming of age into their young adult years, just as that type of media, that information environment was taking off. I mean, what's really important to recognize as well, though, is that Mannheim was talking more about technology in terms of the means of production, that young people when he was writing around the turn of the 20th century, the speed of technological development was really important for them because things were moving on fast and old skills were no longer as valuable. So young people had more power because they understood those new technologies. And that still applies today, but it's much more the big picture on generations is much more those big economic and cultural things, not who understands the latest TikTok trend or whatever it is. It's those really big things that shape life chances that Mannheim was interested in.
That's really interesting. I never thought about it that way. It is true that technically we should have the upper hand in many ways, but economically we just do not. But actually, So tied to this and kind of looking at the discourse around the different generations at the moment, so this may be a somewhat leading question. So are the woke snowflakes really at war with the angry gammons, or do you think that perhaps there's a slight chance that it's more complicated than that?
Yes, it is a bit more complicated. And it is these handy little terms that we've got of snowflakes and gammons, that is a reflection of that type of discourse that we've got now. If you've got one group at one end and one group at the other, when the vast majority of people are in the middle and intergenerational connection is still hugely important to us. And it's, we've got much stronger connections up and down the generations than we have across them in many ways, because through our families and love and connection. Yes, it is more complicated than that. And one of the biggest trends that's really not noticed enough in the UK is how we've drifted apart physically as generations, so that we have sorted young people into cities and large towns and older people outside them in a quite extraordinary way. We think it's quite natural, but it's actually only in the past 30 years that we've had that type of division. So we've got less contact between the generations physically, and then we've also got a digital environment that separates. It's that separation that fuels the stereotyping that leads to this sense of one tribe against another in terms of those types of terms. So it's really, again, those big trends of separation, generational separation, that has driven a lot of this sense of not understanding the other side or stereotyping the other side.
So anecdotally, that reminds me of, so I used to live in quite a trendy part of sort of like quite central East London. And I do remember sort of like leaving that and moving a bit further away in quite a boring neighbourhood and thinking, oh God, children and old people exist. And but I would genuinely like, because I'd spent years and years in a neighbourhood where somehow everyone was between 18 and 35. So I think that's something you've written about before, which I find really interesting, is that there's a number of areas on which actually people do kind of agree with one another. So I think the one you mentioned is that old people do actually care about the environment, and that there's a really weird sort of narrative of, you know, old people just want the planet to burn and Gen Z will save it. But that's actually not the case at all. There's actually a lot of agreement among the age groups, right?
That's right. Yeah, no, it's one of the most destructive generational stereotypes, I think, that we have, because it is, you see it everywhere in all sorts of discussions. So when Greta Thunberg was made Person of the Year by Time magazine in 2019, they called her a standard bearer in a generational battle between old and young. And you're like, that's just not held up. When you look at the survey data on concern about the environment, there's a few percentage point differences between the oldest and youngest on how serious they see environmental issues or climate change. There just isn't that gap. And it's destructive in the sense that exactly the opposite of what we need is to send this sense of division on that type of issue.
Well, so then I guess slightly unhelpfully, what are issues on which actually there are big generational divides? Because I think gender identity seems to be a big one at the moment because it's in the news a lot. But like, is there anything else on which actually, younger and older people do just disagree entirely?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, it's sort of on the cultural debate. So there's a pattern that the youngest generation are always around twice as likely to be comfortable with whatever the emerging social trend is at a particular time. So if you go back to the 1980s, baby boomers were the younger generation. They were twice as comfortable with the idea that women should go to work than the pre-war generation, their parents and grandparents. But then if you roll it forward to the 2020s, and you change the issue to something like whether we should be proud of the British Empire or gender identity, and Gen Z are around twice as likely to be comfortable with the more progressive view of whichever issue you're discussing. And that's kind of like a constant pattern throughout the different periods that have looked at the data. So there's not actually a massive sea change in the gap between old and young. The issues change, but the gap has remained more or less the same. So you're always going to get these differences on cultural issues. On the more economic side, there are differences there, and it is around things like housing, which has been such a core of the different economic outcomes, the worst economic outcomes that younger generations have had, where they're just much more open to and wanting more action on house building and help for house ownership, but also better regulation of private rented housing. There's a few proper crunchy economic issues where younger generations are different, and they're the ones that should be focused on, whether the cultural ones are actually nothing special, but can be used as a wedge issue between old and young.
Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Try Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost, built for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, incredible load times, and 24/7 WordPress priority support, your sites will be lightning fast with global reach. And with Bluehost Cloud, your sites can handle surges in traffic no matter how big. Plus, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. Get started now at Bluehost.com.
So what I find really interesting is that all of what you've just said makes sense, but then that pattern does not match at all with what's happening in electoral politics at the moment, because it is absolutely the case right now that there's a massive generational divide there. So with all the bit about, you know, seven young people backing Labour and all the bit about seven older people backing the Tories. So what's going on there?
It is unprecedented generational, age-based generational gap in voting intention between incredibly older Conservative vote and much younger Labour vote. And the Conservative vote has always had a decent generational hierarchy built into it, where it was older generations supporting the Conservatives, younger generations less, and then younger generations would slowly get a bit more conservative as they age. But there was always still this cohort-based gap. What's completely new is the Labour vote having this really, really steep age divide. I mean, it feels like that's always been the case. But prior to 2015, around 2015, there was no age gradient in Labour's vote, all the way back to 1983, which is when the first data that we had started. So this is completely new. And the reasons for this are both economic and cultural, I would argue, because a lot of the economic decisions have gone against younger generations, undeniably. But then the choices that have been made by governments have gone against them. Then it's evolved and morphed into other issues that boil down into this woke, anti-woke type framing. So we've done both of those things. We've given a really tough economic deal, and then we've put culture change much more at the centre of our politics, which guarantees an age divide in our politics.
But is that why as well? Because I think, and then you made that point, and I felt very silly, actually, because I'd never quite realised it. But you know, I think if we're only talking about young people becoming overwhelmingly left-wing, that misses quite a lot of the picture, which is that also, like, old people did not used to be that overwhelmingly Tory either. So it's very much like two sides there. So do you think that the cultural side and the kind of probably Brexit, post-Brexit sort of hangover explains the fact that older people are now, like, Toryer than ever?
Yeah, I think there is a bit of a dynamic that goes on here where it's when you get these, I think age divides in politics are really potentially destructive because it gives one side a sense that demography is on their side and they just have to sit back and wait and they'll have increasing voting come to them. It makes the other side think the same in some ways, but then get even more irate and desperate to pull their base towards them by emphasising the risks of the other side. So I think the fervency of that older vote, which is true, is the highest, you know, proportions of baby boomers in the pre-war generation that view themselves as Conservative supporters, is a really important part of this dynamic too. This isn't just about millennials killing something. It is about this whole generational spectrum of very, very entirely different views between that older pre-war generation and then even below millennials. Gen Z are even more rejectionist of that Conservative offer right now and even more supportive of Labour. And that's really risky, I think. It's a very unusual thing to divide people on so comprehensively age as a characteristic.
Like in this particular case, politics kind of is a zero-sum game in that, you know, they're trying so hard to hold on to their older voter base because they really need to, you know, have some people voting for them. But the more they do that, the more they are actually actively turning off younger voters. So like how do you get out of that? I mean, I suspect there is not an easy answer, otherwise they would be doing it right now. But is there something they could do to kind of escape from that vicious cycle?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. Yeah, I think that describes it really well. It is a vicious cycle, and it is incredibly difficult to get out of. And you do feel that there is a need for complete reinvention or reconnection for the Conservative Party to that younger age group. It's not going to just happen with little tweaks here and there. Having said that, some of the analysis talking about this being the death of the political life cycle is also not true. These rules in politics, these patterns tend to reinforce themselves, and politics is such an unpredictable mix of age, period, and cohort effects in terms of outcomes. It's impossible to say that that is now gone for good. And so I think with a different offer, you could see how millennials and Gen Z could be pulled back into that more normal current of a life cycle effect over time. But it's not going to happen soon, and it's not going to happen without a big change.
It's, yeah, I mean, what I find sort of oddly maddening as someone who's been covering politics for a while is that actually, if you really think about what the Tories could do, it's effectively just reinvent David Cameron and Cameronism. So it's a bit like the last 12 years sort of, you know, didn't really happen or need to happen again. Like, time is a flat circle and nothing matters. Anyway, moving on, I'm doing fine. But so I guess, again, so like looking historically, so why actually did past generations go more Tory with age? So thinking about the post-war generation and the boomers, so were there specific events or points that made entire generations switch, or was it more about personal circumstances for those individual people?
Yeah, it's such a great question. It's such a heady mix, politics, of these three effects that describe all change, which, you know, there's a life cycle effect, but then you also have cohort effects where, you know, a generation is different, it was brought up in a different sort of time. And then you've got period effects where something happens and that affects everyone and changes things. And politics is the biggest blend, the most complex blend of those three effects that in any of the areas that I look at. So that is the reality of what's happened over these times. It's going to be a blend and mix of those different types of effects. But life cycle effects were pretty solid and did go for a long time through that post-war period, where you would just see this pattern of people just drifting towards conservatism. And it's really very understandable because it, you know, it goes back to the Mannheim and other people's points about how we get to a certain point in life and you start to change less, you start to be less adaptable. And that does point towards that more traditionalist view of society. And so it's completely understandable that has been a pattern and that it will, like in all likelihood, reinforce itself again in the future once we get past this pretty unusual period that we're in now.
So is this, I mean, and I'm always wary of trying to find sort of like easy fixes for stuff in politics. But so is this also maybe a case that generally just childcare and housing are, you know, are shafting the Tories more than anything else? And actually, like, quite a lot of people, thinking about quite a lot of my peers even, if they could just buy quite a nice house and have their two kids and, you know, a car, maybe two cars, let's go nuts, would actually probably, you know, but sort of become again Tory in that nearly apolitical way. Because I think that's what the Conservative Party is normally quite good at, right? Of like turning people into Tories without them identifying as Tories. So is that, you know, if someone had a magic wand and could fix both housing and childcare, do you think that would sort of change everything? Or is it, again, a bit more complicated than that?
I do think that those types of issues are right at the core of this, and particularly housing, from my perspective, on just looking at there doesn't seem to be a solution to generational, intergenerational connection without that solution to housing, because it's just so at the heart of so much of life chances and wealth generation and feelings of independence, and just it's just shaping people's lives in entirely different ways. Just looking at the charts about how people have been deflected from expected life courses just because the housing market is broken. And I do think childcare hugely important too, and as well. And I think there are very practical things to do. And I am surprised that there hasn't been more concerted effort to have a comprehensive approach to housing policy that looks at it all from private rented, social rented, and ownership point of view, because it's such an obvious thing to do. And it's not even creating that sense of conservatism that helps the conservatives. It's just allowing people to follow a life course that results in that quite naturally, because your priorities do change. But it's being completely blocked right now for large proportions of the population. I have to say as well that, look, that is not unique to the UK, and any government that was going through this period would have struggled with lots of this, because the book is international in scope, so it's looking across lots of different countries on these economic measures. And that sense of a loss of faith in a better future for younger generations is quite prevalent across lots of Western, more developed countries, where you get more people now saying that they think the future for young people is going to be worse rather than better, compared to back in the 2000s, where more people said it was going to be better rather than worse. So we've got this general global decline in sense of the automatic generation-on-generation progress that we'd got used to post-war.
So I was going to bring that up. So I think taking a broader look, so this kind of generational split, is it really replicated elsewhere? Because I know, so in the US, young people are way more likely to be voting for the Democrats, but old people are actually not that overwhelmingly likely to be Republicans. And even on the other side of that, so, you know, I'm French, and I find it really striking that actually quite a generally like quite significant minority of my age cohort votes for the National Front, or like the Rassemblement National, as they're called these days. In France, for example, it is not the case that, you know, all young French people have gone super, super left. A lot of them have gone for the far right instead. In the US, quite complicated, etc. So what was going on elsewhere? Like, how does Britain compare, I guess, to other, especially Western countries?
Yeah, we're quite an extreme example of lots of the patterns that you see. There's one really important point about this type of generational analysis, and it's kind of, I always say that we should be looking at country before cohort, which is not a very snappy way of saying it, but it's effectively means that quite often the cultural context and the national context outweighs the generational context. When Mannheim, for example, was looking at generational differences, he only really thought about generations in a national sense. He wasn't really thinking cross country, that you would expect to see similar patterns in generations across countries, because it was quite a disconnected world then. And we've had a very particular type of context in the UK, not least around Brexit, the run-up and aftermath of Brexit, the political turmoil that we've seen. So we are quite different in many ways, and that's not even going into the economic factors that make us quite different and behind the curve in many aspects. So country context still matters hugely, and will push generations in different countries in very different directions, and we should expect that.
That was fascinating. Thank you. I think we should probably do an entire other podcast on that. But in the meantime, Bobby Duffy, thank you so much.
No problem. That was great. Thanks, Marie.
Listeners, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can back us on Patreon so we can keep making them. There's a link in the show notes, or just search Bunker Patreon Podcast. For as little as £3 a month, you'll get access to episodes early and without adverts, as well as exclusive merchandise offers. I'm Marie LeConte, and thanks for joining me in the bunker.
The Bunker was presented by Marie LeConte.
Produced by Kasia Tomasiewicz. Audio production came from me, Robin Leeburn. Lead producer is Jacob Jarvis. Group editor, Andrew Harrison. Theme music by Kenny Dickinson. And The Bunker is a Podmasters production.